identifies people of interest and even identifies ordinary Glaswegians going about their business, and then decides to dig very deeply into their private life. It raises very fundamental questions, yeah. Not just about transparency or the complete lack of it. It raises fundamental questions about the right to a private life. Perhaps that's one of the reasons why it is dealt with so, I think, furtively.
Yeah. Well, David, tell us about Britain's role in establishing the Israeli military in the first place.
Well, we did a show on this a while ago, and there was this Irish guy who was involved in setting up the yes. Jewish Legion, which fought in the British military, indeed fought in Jerusalem. Amongst its leaders was the revisionist Zionist, Vladimir Jabotinsky, changed his name later to Zev Jabotinsky, one of the leaders of the organisation which became the Irgun, the terror gang, which was involved, in, of course, in bombing British soldiers and officers, and indeed in the massacres of Arab and Palestinian civilians. So this organisation was the kind of the kernel of what became the IDF, the Jewish Legion, and the British Army. So the British Army effectively, organisationally set up the IDF, even though in its birth the Irgun and other Zionist terror gangs were involved actually in committing terrorism against the British Empire. But you know, that's the origin of the IDF.
Very interesting. Nick, just to remind us, will you, about Britain's part in developing Israeli apartheid during the mandate period as well?
Well, David's mentioned the military side of it. Can I just add a little tidbit? Horrific, though. Matthew Hughes in the Journal of Imperial History has an article about how the British brutalised Jewish troops during the mandate. Now, that doesn't mean how Israeli troops brutalised Palestinians by beating and smashing them up. What he meant was that British troops like Wingate and others trained Israeli soldiers in the methods of counterinsurgency, attacking civilians, attacking innocent villages that had been perfected throughout the British Empire. Look, Israel's a species of colonialism, actually settler colonialism. You can't have that without a species of apartheid. I mean, on a clear day, you can look from Scotland to Northern Ireland, and over there, we still have, despite the end of the war, we still have walls between communities.
Yes.
Britain deliberately divided communities against each other, and in Palestine, they did so on steroids.
Yeah. Well thanks for that, Nick. We're just going to pause there for a moment. This report now on how Israeli firms are penetrating the National Health Service in the UK.
The UK Israel Tech Hub is a body through which Israel pursues its economic and digital interest in Britain. But is it serving other interests related to espionage? Here, the former director of the organisation, Aidan Fisher, can barely conceal his glee that the British taxpayer is funding the integration of the Israeli and British economies.
So the Hub is a very unique initiative. It's actually funded by the British government. We're based at the embassy in Tel Aviv, just opposite the Hilton Hotel. Actually, the stage in which we operate, a lot of the time the money actually flows from the UK to Israel. We find ourselves helping Israeli companies, especially if they're in their seed or round A stage, mm-hmm. because we have an interest. Our interest is to increase the stickiness, to increase the ties between the UK and Israel.
Palestine Declassified previously revealed the 2012 Netanyahu policy of moving agents of Israeli military intelligence, Unit 8200, into private companies to continue their work. Is the UK-Israel Tech Hub a vehicle for that? It should be disconcerting for British taxpayers to note that the British embassy-backed project has been integral to the signing of a memorandum of understanding between Israel and the Northern Health Services Alliance to facilitate the expansion of the Israeli tech industry into the NHS. Through the tech hub, something called the UK-Israel Health Tech Gateway has been established, which will give Israeli tech companies access to vast swathes of health data on British citizens. The UK-Israel Tech Hub has been extensively supported by previous subjects of the Palestine Declassified investigation, British Telecom and Mishkon Derea. This is all symptomatic of a much wider push at economic, digital, and intelligence integration between Britain and Israel, as outlined in a research paper for the largest Israel lobby group in the country, BICOM. The paper even seems to ominously imply that the British ambassador to Israel may have been cultivated by the Zionists, stating, "The UK and Israeli national strategies for addressing cyber challenges have developed in parallel with acknowledged cross-fertilization between them. It is perhaps no coincidence that former UK ambassador to Israel, Matthew Gold, returned from his posting in Tel Aviv in 2015 to become director of cybersecurity at the UK Cabinet Office. The document also asserts that the UK's National Security Establishment's programme, Cyber Discovery, which grooms children into cybersecurity professionals, on the Maximum programme in Israeli school. The Maximum is the infamous Unit 8200 school programme that cultivates children to be Israeli spies. The level of digital integration between Israel and Britain has reached unprecedented levels, with an anonymous senior British official describing Israel as a first-order partner in cybersecurity. It would seem wise to wonder what data former Israeli spies have access to through such integration.
David, what do you make of this BICOM paper that lays out extensive digital collaboration between Britain and Israel?
Well, integration is the word that they're using, and it does seem to be a really very significant melding between British activities and Israeli activities. And of course, these are not just business activities, these are also, as we've seen in the film there, activities which have an intelligence component or an intelligence interest. So the involvement there in the health tech hub, for example, very worrying that Israeli tech firms staffed by people from formerly in Israeli intelligence agencies are able to get access to data in the British National Health Service. The National Health Service is seen by everyone in this country as being a massive achievement, but are we really opening up the access, the data in the NHS to Israeli startups and indeed possibly to Israeli intelligence organizations? Can that really be the idea that most people have of what the NHS is for?
Well, Mick, I mean, Idan Fisher, the former director of the UK-Israel Tech Hub, can barely contain himself when asked about British funding. I mean, is this what state capture looks like, do you think?
It's a quid pro quo. Israel makes itself very useful to Britain and to the West in general. I mean, one Israeli prime minister described Israel as a disgusting language, a villa in the jungle. Herzl himself said it was an outpost of European civilization among savages of a sort. So Israel's there as an extension, a crusader state, if you like, which can be called upon, if need be, to deal with anyone who stands up to Western diktat. So I'm not surprised that the integration is so close. Now, your viewers may even know about Jonathan Pollard. Jonathan Pollard was an American who actually stole container loads of American secrets and delivered them to Israel, for which he was given a life sentence released recently. Of course, Israel will use this access in order to steal data. That's what states do. The problem is, and it's a very pressing problem, is that the surveillance system I've already alluded to in Glasgow, it is sold on the strength of massive surveillance and then rapid integration of the individual who's identified with their social media posts. But even there, health data was deemed to be off limits. Now, once they get access to health data, then all sorts of blackmail becomes possible. And you have to remember that 43 Israeli soldiers, and they were Zionists, resigned from the unit that's mothered all this technology because it was used in order to surveil and blackmail Palestinians. This is malign technology. And once it gets access, it breaks the barrier into medical data. Yeah. Then the warning issued by those Israeli soldiers that it can be used to blackmail, intimidate, force people to collaborate, force people to change their political behavior, becomes even more serious. So I think this information that you're uncovering is very, very significant for British people.
Yeah. But David, tell us why Unit 8200, the Israeli intelligence corps, is relevant to this conversation then.
Well, so, I mean, it's relevant in many ways. First of all, what we've already been saying, which is the travelling of people who used to be in this Israeli intelligence agency into tech startups and therefore into the corporate world where they can get access to data. But also this Mag Shamim programme, where they have this training programme essentially to groom children to become Israeli intelligence agents. And that programme itself has been taken over and transposed by GCHQ in this country to bring kids into the intelligence services here. Wow. So we have a parallel there as well. And that's not the end of it. I mean, this is really a problem about the many ways in which Israeli intelligence are able to access data in this country. Mick's talking about the surveillance program, there's the health question, and then of course there's the involvement, as we've seen in the previous program, of Patrick Drahi, the Zionist billionaire, who's now the largest single stakeholder, a shareholder in British Telecom. Yeah. So there's a really significant issue here of multiple sources of data available to Israeli intelligence over almost all British citizens.
Mm. Well, Mick, I mean, what do you think the ramifications of the UK-Israel health tech gateway could actually be then?
Now, look, people joke that most countries, most states have an army, but the Israeli army has a state. What they mean is that the military so saturates and penetrates every aspect of the Israeli economy, political and social life, that you can't divide them off. And when these tech companies get an entry into British economic life, into the health service, for example, you're giving it to the Israeli military. Now, we remember that Huawei was supposed to be stripped out of its core functions in the British telecommunications structures because it could be used by the Communist Party. I mean, we were told that we had to be wary of TikTok because the Chinese Communist Party could use it. It became ridiculous. But it's not ridiculous to say that the Israeli security establishment will be directing these capitalists, will be directing these industrialists, and these industrialists will have no freedom of manoeuvre compared to the Israeli security establishment. So, yes, they've already got themselves a significant position in the UK pharmaceutical industry, the pharmacy industry, where something called Teva supplies a lot of pharmaceuticals.
Yeah.
Once again, that's all done behind the scenes. Nobody, if it were called Israeli drugs, nobody would buy them, but it's already there significantly. So, yeah, it's very worrying. It's very worrying.
Well, David, tell us about this Mag Shamim program in Israeli schools and its application in Britain.
So, I mean, as I was saying, I mean, this program is about grooming children to become intelligence agents, and they go through hacker training programs and competitions. And there are hacker competitions. One of the guys who set up the Wix company, WIX, one of the startups there, he was a previous winner of an internal Unit 8200 hacking program where he hacked into the computers of three hostile states. Now we don't know which ones they were, but we can imagine which ones they were. Mm. And he went on then to form this web company. People still have websites on the Wix using the Wix software. And the same thing's been happening in the UK. There, GCHQ runs competitions like that. And it's the integration which is the worrying thing. For example, the guy who was the ambassador in Tel Aviv, Matthew Gould, who went on to become the director of cybersecurity in the cabinet office. And of course, his next job after that was to be involved with the cyber work in tech work in the health service.
Yes.
So he was actually overseeing the Israeli involvement in the health service technology. So that's a really significant problem there.
Are there any other similar examples, you think, like Matthew Gould? Or, I mean, was he a one-off?
Well, there's an integration increasingly between the interests of the Israelis and parts of the government apparatus in this country. So Gould is one example. There are many other examples of people who are effectively operating for the interests of the Israelis inside the governmental apparatus in Whitehall and in Westminster.
Oh, very interesting. Well, I'm afraid that we're out of time today. I hope you found the programme informative again. I want to thank our guests, Mick Napier, and our resident expert, of course, Professor David Miller. And thank you for joining us today. We'll be back next week with more investigations and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm your host, Zainab. And today in our studio, we have with us Islamic researcher and educationalist, Dr. Ali Alavi. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you very much for inviting me to your show.
We have been discussing about self-confidence, mm-hmm. and we discussed a lot about it. And now I would want to know about some signs that tell us a child has lowered self-confidence. Mm-hmm. Because we talked about the signs which show us that your child has good self-confidence. Now I want you to tell us the signs that show your child has lowered self-confidence.
Definitely. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. I just want to remind the respected listeners about the signs of kids or children who have a good self-confidence, and they are known as self-confident people. They are, as we said earlier, they are independent in their actions and activities, and also they act maturely in their actions. They are honored of, and they are proud of whatever they are doing, and actually they talk about their outcomes and, let's say, consequences very openly. And they accept the failure that they have. If you remember, we said that these are the signs that it shows that our kid is self-confident. And he responsively accepts his failures. The next is that he has the courage of entering in new arenas and challenges and accepts the risk, the risks of any challenge. And the next was that in some occasions, he has this ability and capability to help others.
Yeah.
So these signs show that our kid is self-confident. So definitely there must be something in the other side, that is what is in opposite.
Yeah.
So what are the signs that tells us, okay, that this kid and this girl, this son of us, is poor in self-confidence?
Yeah.
So one, the first thing that I can refer to is that unlike the other one, that he actually welcomes all risks and challenges, he doesn't welcome any challenges and
any
new opportunities.
Yeah.
You see, this child actually feels that no one loves him and actually no one wants him. Do you remember, I think,
feeling
one of the discussions?
Insecurity.
Yeah.
Okay.
Feeling of insecurity that we had it earlier, that we said that these are the reasons that actually he understands that he is not being loved anymore by somebody.
All right.
Look, sometimes a word of mother or father that I hate you, it's very easy to be uttered, but it has a bad effect on the personality of the kid.
All right.
Look, this kid cannot digest it, at least at that time, though they are too smart, but they think that everything is direct and there is no lie in between. See, or there is at least no pretension, or there is no conspiracy that we parents usually have. So when you tell them that I hate you, he really takes it for himself or herself.
He thinks you really hate him.
Definitely. So when you tell them that they feel that no one loves them anymore or wants them, the next, if you have seen a kid with this circumstance that he thinks that no one is loving him or her, it means that his self-confidence has been damaged somewhere. We have to try to treat and cure it.
Yeah. So we will discuss more signs after a short break. Dear listeners, sure. Stay tuned with us.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I am with Dr. Ali Alavi, and we are talking about self-confidence. Dr. Alavi, you have been helping us to know about the signs that show that our children have got lowered self-confidence.
Yeah. We have been talking about two or three signs of those who lack self-confidence. One is that they are not welcoming any opportunities or challenges. Second, they think that no one loves them and wants them. Third, is the time to say that they try to blame others for their own mistakes. You see? So we said that in the opposite side. Those who have enough self-confidence, they actually accept their failures responsibly. But with this subject, we see that they try to actually blame others for their own mistakes, and they are not going to accept their failures. The next factor or the next element that tells us that this kid or this subject is afflicted with a lack of self-confidence is that they are unable to cope with normal levels or with any issue very smoothly. So they find everything quite difficult. In order to, for example, in case you ask them to do something, they might count too many problems and too many difficulties on the way to perform it.
Okay.
So it seems that, okay, he is actually, he feels that he is not the person to cope with this problem.
He feels like, you'll feel with his statements, he knows he's not capable of, or he at has least, this feeling of his capability.
At least, yeah, it has been, he tries to persuade himself that he is not capable of doing it, though he has this capability to perform it. And it has some actually treatment in order to tell them that, no, you are capable enough to perform, to act, and to do this.
Mm-hmm.
So even with some simple word, we can actually revive this sense of capability in the subject. The next sign that actually we can find in such subjects is that they have a sort of, let's say, a negative self-talk about their own selves. If you remember, we said in the factors that leads to the weakening the self-confidence, we said that when they are compared with others.
Yeah.
You see, now they have heard too much comparison, and now they just say, okay, I'm not the one that can do it. See, I'm not suitable for this case. They say lots of negative
self-talk. They fail before making any efforts.
Definitely. They find, this failure from the very beginning, you see? So what's the reason? The reason is due to that bad comparisons that have been made earlier. Mm-hmm. And even with the same case that you actually referred to, the question of the person or the brother or sister who sent the question to this show.
Yeah.
Such a person always is in fear of a failure, or he or she is always in the fear or embarrassment of an action that might come to him or her.
Mm-hmm.
And they have, again, if you see that your kid or child is not able to make a good friendship with others, it means that there is something wrong there. So what's wrong? Because, kids in this age, or let's say in the ages that we are talking about, let's say the ages of 9 and 10 and over, they have to naturally have this power to find good friends.
Yeah.
But we see that they are not able to make it. It means that there is something wrong with them because they feel humiliated, and they feel that no one, they deserve to be the friend of no one.
Mm-hmm.
You see, that's the problem that they are always with. The next element or the next sign that we can see in this series, or in this subject, is that their interest and motivation for doing everything is lower than the kids in the same age. For example, if you define a very good, let's say, occasion or even event for them that is usually loved by kids of the same age,
yeah,
it seems that they are not that interested to go. They prefer to stay at home and actually do nothing.
Make excuses
not to attend that event.
Well, we'll discuss more on that after a short break, dear listeners. Stay tuned with us.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, "Honor your children and teach them good manners."
Welcome back. You're listening to The Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Dr. Ali Alavi, and we're talking about self-confidence. Dr. Alavi is helping us to know about the signs that show that your child has a lower self-confidence. Yes, Dr. Alavi.
Yeah. The next sign that we can find in the kids or children of... in some kids or children who are, let's say, afflicted with low self-confidence is that they try not to accept the definitions or, let's say, descriptions that are being done about themselves, about them. For example, if their mother or father actually describe them in a good way, they try not to accept it and they say these are quite nonsense because I know that I'm not that, let's say, talented, and they are just going to make me happy, they say these things. So it means that it has been ruined from somewhere, this ability has been destroyed somewhere, and I don't know whether from the parents or the guardians or the teachers at school or anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
But this time he cannot accept himself a good, let's say.
All your praises are in vain, whatever the praises you're making about your child.
He or she thinks that he or she does not deserve these kind of praises and definitions or lesser descriptions that are being made.
Or maybe he feels like they're lying.
Yeah, they're lying for him, yeah, definitely. And usually, for some, that, for example, human beings usually, I mean, we also as human beings, usually got happy when we are praised, you see.
Yeah.
Though it's also a good another illness that has to be cured in its own place.
Well, I'm a female, and I know we have this illness very, very deeply.
Yeah. So it is good to some extent.
You said with the emphasis.
No. I didn't mean that. Being praised is not something that usually people get happy when they are praised, right?
Yeah.
But we have to be careful. Always this sense of being praised, in case everything actually exceeds its borders and limits, it would be problems.
Are you trying to say that praise is good, but when praise becomes flattering, it is problematic?
Problematic, and it will cause problems. But these actually group of subjects, they are usually reject such praises, and they think that whatever has been said or told about them are not real, and they feel a sort of anxiety and let's say stress when they are praised. So they try to reject and not accept all these praises about themselves. But one more point and finalizing my discussion. Inshallah, we shall move to the ways to strengthen this self-confidence in our kids in our upcoming session.
I'm waiting for that.
Yeah. We want to tell the respected parents and the respected audience of this show that self-confidence does not happen overnight and cannot be revived again overnight.
Wow.
Yeah. So it means that it has, a series of events had happened already that led to lack of self-confidence in one.
Mm-hmm.
And series of other actions have happened by some, let's say, thinkers that led to the, a good self-confidence of the other.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to be careful in order to, we first need to know what elements actually lead us towards this and what elements lead us toward that. So these are the issues that we have to know as parents and audience, and as parents and the guardians of our kids. Mm-hmm. Inshallah, in our upcoming session, we shall focus on some methods and ways in order to strengthen their self-confidence.
Thank you, Dr. Alavi, for being with us with such great information. Dear listeners, we so far talked about the self-confidence in children. What are the signs that show highest level of self-confidence? What are the signs that show lowered self-confidence? And now we'll be moving towards the ways to strengthen and to boost this self-confidence, which is very, very necessary. So stay tuned with us until another session. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. This is a part of political divine will of the founder of Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini. Among the teachers and professors were, of course, some committed and considerate ones. However, they were too few and too restricted to take appropriate action, along with these and tens of other problems, including exile and isolation of the clerics and defaming many of them through malicious propaganda. It would have been impossible for their nation to revolt unitedly throughout the country. They were not unified in target, with motto of Allahu Akbar and with dazzling and miraculous sacrifices to drive away all the internal and external powers and to take the reins of power into their own hands. Therefore, the Islamic revolution in Iran is totally different from all other revolutions.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear audience from all over the world. You are listening to the program Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio. I'm Zainab Musavi, and in this program, we try to talk about the precious and worthy sentences and words of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh about different modern and classic subjects. About the subject of knowledge and the knowledgeable, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh says that knowledge and performance, knowledge and commitment are the two wings that can soar together to the highest stage of progress and excellence. Well, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh in this speech is informing us about the secret of success, and that is the company of knowledge and performance. The company of these two concepts is so much important that Imam rahmatullah compares them to the wings of a bird which cannot operate without each other. This speech is aligned with Imam Ali alayhi salam's narration saying that فَمَنْ عَلِمَ عَمِلْ العلم مقرون بالعمل والعلم يهتف بالعمل فإن أجابه وإلا ارتحل عنه. The translation of this narration is that knowledge is accompanied by performance, and whoever is really knowledgeable takes action. Knowledge invites performance. In case it comes, they will both stay, and if not, soon the knowledge will leave. We can see that Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh, just like our infallible Imam, is trying to signify the great necessity of performance in accordance to knowledge, and knowledge accompanied by performance. We have seen that there are lots of scientists in the society who are not much useful for the society. You know, they are not only considered as fruitless, but also they are even harmful for the society. And that is because they just have gathered knowledge, and they can recite whatever they have learned without putting that into action. And definitely in case those scientists put what they know into action, a very different and ideal community and society would be the result. And that is, according to Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh, a necessity for the society.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing Iran's strategic naval force with the commander of Iran's navy, Admiral Shahram Irani. But first, this brief analysis.
In the early 20th century, U.S. Navy Admiral Alfred Mahan theorized that in order for a nation to be the primary global power, it needs to control all the major naval choke points located in the world's oceans and seas. He theorized about the vital geostrategic importance of what he named, quote, the Middle East, the area that is Western Asia and the connecting point between Asia, Africa, and Europe. His views were enthusiastically adopted by the British Empire, the dominant empire of the time, who in the wake of the decline of the Ottoman Empire began to dominate the region. This meant that no local nation was allowed to develop naval power as a rival to Britain, including Iran, which had a naval tradition going back to ancient history. The United States inherited the strategy of global naval dominance following World War II when it became the inheritor of the British Empire, including the part related to not allowing regional nations such as Iran to develop their naval capabilities. All this changed after the Islamic Revolution in Iran and the imposed war in the 1980s, which saw Iran gradually develop its navy into the strategic force that it has become today. Today, the Iranian Navy is challenging the lie spread by the U.S. Navy that it is providing so-called security in the region by providing real security in cooperation with other regional nations and advocating the expulsion of all foreign navies from the region and showing that their presence in the region is redundant. The Iranian Navy has also shown its ability to fly the flag in distant seas, from the Caribbean Sea and Latin America to the English Channel and the North Sea, to the Straits of Malacca and the South China Sea. As Iran takes its place as a rising power in the post-American multipolar global order, so will its strategic naval power increase, and the world will witness its permanent naval presence in the world's oceans and seas in cooperation with its strategic partners from around the globe.
Admiral Shahram Irani, commander of the Iranian Navy, thank you so much for joining us on Insight. As we spoke before the program, you know, our program tries to look at the current events and the events that occur in the news from a more strategic and historic perspective. In our previous programs in the past two seasons, we've talked a lot about the geostrategic plans and geostrategic different views that have existed among Western strategic planners, all the way beginning with Halford Mackinder, which were more focused on land and on issues related to the army and geo in terms of land and geostrategics. And we mentioned very briefly in some parts the marine and naval aspect of this, which at the same time as this was happening at the end of the 19th century and the 20th century, we have people like Admiral Mahan in the United States theorizing this global British-American, Anglo-American empire from a marine perspective, the idea that in order for Britain and then America as the inheritor of the British Empire following World War II, in order for them to rule the world, they have to control all the strategic choke points, marine choke points in the world, places such as the Strait of Hormuz, Bab al-Mandab in Yemen, Suez Canal, Eastern Mediterranean, the Dardanelles, the Bosphorus, Straits of Bosphorus, exactly our region of the world, the most important strategic region as they have been claiming for over 100 years. If we look at history, we see that the British and all, other Western powers actually used pirates as part of their global naval strategies. The famous pirates that are maybe known in history were actually part of a larger naval strategy by the British to indirectly engage and to attack their enemies without having to suffer the consequences of having a direct naval confrontation with the rival powers that they were doing. So what you're saying is that this policy still exists today, that a lot of the things that were called Somali pirates or the pirates that existed in the northern Indian Ocean, in the Bab al-Mandab area, were actually pirates and forces that were connected to the Americans and the Western naval forces.
اینجا یه نکته ویژه وجود داره شاید پنهان خیلی بهش
There's a special point here that may be left unsaid and is not being paid much attention to. When does this happen, and at what point? Where in the Indian Ocean? It happens in an area in the Indian Ocean where there is no navy. None of these countries have naval power, unfortunately. That is, you should note that from the countries on the shores of the Persian Gulf to those on the shores of the Red Sea and Suez Canal, no one has a naval power. How do you explain this situation? The message it sends out refers to the same doctrine that you mentioned. That is, they have chosen a strategy to insinuate that they are the only ones who are able to be present at the sea and bring security. That is, if the area becomes insecure, there will be no one around to come to the rescue. In that case, they can safely announce that they are the only ones who can protect and guard you. They intend to convince the countries of the region that they are the only one, that they are the only sea power available. So what happened? At that time, one of our ships was also hijacked by these pirates. That's when a new chapter in the history of the country's navy began. Since 2009, a decree was issued that the strategic navy of the Islamic Republic of Iran is responsible for the security of our shipping and the task of protecting the economic artery of the country.
Do I understand you correctly? So we're talking about the security of all ships in that area. It's not only about the Iranian ships that would be coming in. Of course, they have the priority, but in a way, Iran is saying to the world that Iran is able, capable of doing what they've been saying that they are the only ones that are capable of doing, that if they don't exist, then there's no security in the seas. But Iran is showing that, yes, when you, even if they're not there, Iran can give the security to that region of the world, that very important strategic region of the world. Did I understand correctly what you're saying?
Okay, here I would like to draw your attention to the fact that this growth is realized step by step. In the first step, we have an order that the security of Iran's shipping lines should be maintained. When you have presence in a region and you establish security for yourself, the whole region benefits from that security. In the big picture, this security expands its borders. That is, in fact, the country of Iran has gifted this security to the world because the ships of all countries of the world pass through this area.
So in other words, what you're saying is that we are hitting the very basic argument that they have been making for over 100 years, which is that we are the ones that give security, naval and marine and security on the seas. And yet Iran has now come into the scene and is saying to them and to the world that there's no need for the Americans or for the Westerners to be here. We as a local nation, as a local power, are able to give this security not only for ourselves but for the whole world, and there's no need for these foreigners to come from tens of thousands of miles away to do this. Did I understand this correctly?
Yes, it is exactly the same, but I want to share a point with you. During this period, since 2009, we have convoyed more than 5,000 ships belonging to the Islamic Republic. We had more than 200 direct clashes with pirates. It is interesting for you to know that among the 20 ships we saved, one belonged to the Americans, and they asked us for help. The help request was actually in an area where they claimed to be present. You correctly used the word lie, but I say a monstrous lie. Claiming that they want to establish security is not a white lie, but a bare-faced big lie. They were not even able to help their own ship. They didn't help other ships either. In one case, they had a clash with pirates in which members from both their own forces and the crew of the ship they were trying to save were killed. But the Iranian Navy had two direct skirmishes without a single casualty. We have had more than 200 clashes to this day. But would it not hurt even one pirate? Because in our opinion, these are not thieves. These are poor people who are being abused. And it is necessary for the people of the world to know that we arrested a number of pirates in one of the naval operations against pirates when we saved a Chinese vessel. But would it not take these arrested thieves or pirates to Guantanamo to perform immoral and inhumane experiments on them? They are human beings like us. So they all came to the Islamic Republic of Iran and took training courses and learned jobs. Then they returned to their own countries and engaged in various professions, including carpentry and tailoring, and the jobs they were able to do, including mechanics and the fields that they were interested in, such as handicrafts. Today, those people are no longer thieves. I would like to share with you another point. Pay attention to these people who are stealing in the sea now. What kind of people are they? These are all Muslims. Our enemy wants to show the world that Muslims do not have the ability to govern themselves and therefore they commit crimes. But it's wrong. Muslims have many abilities. But unfortunately, they've been oppressed and they've been in a situation where they had to engage in a piracy. Now, what is the result of Iran's efforts? What happened? We were encouraged and appreciated in several stages, both in writings and at various meetings. But for what reason? Because although we had came to establish security and safety for our vessels, and we have always said, not changing slogans, that this region has the capacity and capability and that the countries of the region can reject foreign forces and establish security together hand in hand. Here I feel a need to emphasize again that their ships also pass through this safe area. But nevertheless, they try to make it look unsafe in various ways. Well, here, as you said, a naval power has come to the scene. But this naval power today does not intend to boast about its capabilities. This is not our basis. The basis of our work is in the form of maritime or defense diplomacy. We carry the Iranian flag and proudly wave it in the seas and sail and defend the countries of the region. We pay visits to them and show our capabilities and deliver this message to all of them.
That's very interesting, Admiral. So I want to move a little bit further away from our own area, where you talked about the northern Indian Ocean, you talked about this area that we've been able to really establish security here without the need for any foreign powers. But we've also witnessed and we've also seen that the Iranian Navy is moving in all areas of the world. We've had the very famous and important mission to the Caribbean Sea and towards the Atlantic Ocean in Venezuela, which was, of course, everybody in the world was astonished to see that Iran was able to do this. We had the trip to St. Petersburg, which it went through the Mediterranean and up through the English Channel and towards the North Sea. Of course, we had some years back the mission that you were the commander of going through the Suez Canal for the first time in many years for the Iranian Navy and going into the Eastern Mediterranean. And also we see recently now that a naval group is going towards the east, the Straits of Malacca, Indonesia, and on to other areas. So if you could please briefly, give us some details about every one of these missions and if there's anything in the future that we have plans for.
خدمتتون عرض بکنم که من یه کوچولو توضیح بدم که ما یک اجلاس فرماندهان حاشیه اقیانوس هند داریم در با عنوان آیونز مخففشه.
You may want to know that there is an initiative named Indian Ocean Naval Symposium, which includes three working groups: the Maritime Security Group, the Humanitarian Assistance in Disaster Relief Group, and finally, the Information Sharing and Interoperability Group. Due to our maritime activities during this period, we have the honor of chairing two working groups, which in fact are the most important ones: the Maritime Security Group, in which most countries are members, and the Humanitarian Assistance and Disaster Relief Group, which is relevant to the whole world. But on the issue you mentioned, I said that we use the advantage of access. We felt the need to go further and experience other sea and ocean areas. After all, we are sailors. We have the equipment. We also have the science. Well, you should know that when we were invited to attend an official ceremony in St. Petersburg, in respect to this invitation, we sailed this route steadfastly. During this period, we were subjected to numerous negative propaganda campaigns from the enemy. They spread lies against our navy, claiming that we intend to make the region insecure, sell weapons and deliver arms, but we did not enter any country or dock at any port except St. Petersburg. Our navy sailed 45,000 kilometers and crossed two or three oceans and seas. We crossed all those canals and waterways you mentioned and arrived at St. Petersburg, participated in the ceremony, and then returned. Our fleet proudly crossed the Suez Canal and returned to the country. Today, yes, we are present in the Straits of Malacca because our vessels are moving there. We will cover and convoy our ships every day. Well, it was a question for everyone whether the Iranian Navy has disability and how it acquired disability. Let me tell you a memory from this trip. During this trip, I experienced the hardest and most terrible storms that I had seen in all my years of sailing. A strong wind with speeds up to 160 kilometers per hour affected us for 8 days. The strength of the sea storms was so high that no vessel could sail nearby. No one. For all the countries there, it was surprising how the Iranian Navy was able to sail sustainably in this Mediterranean environment and in this very rough sea. We stayed there until the day the sea calmed down and displayed our sea prowess and then returned. Regarding the future, as you mentioned, this is our basis. Our basis is diplomacy. Our basis is friendship. Our basis is the exchange of capabilities. Our basis is not empty promises, and we never intend to boast. All the countries of the world have this will and power, but they should make an effort and be present in the sea themselves, and they can establish their own security. But here, because it is a region that belongs to different countries, our presence doesn't mean that others do not need to be present. The difference between the discourse of the Islamic Republic and the West is that we have always said that we would like to establish the security of the region with the cooperation of other countries. But they say that the security of the region can only be achieved by themselves, and that they only want to plunder our resources. See how different the discourse is? Iranians have a very rich and humanitarian culture. We have the highest respect for the human being that God created and brought on earth. And this is a lesson. It will be the same in the future and will be present in the sea with more modern facilities. Today, our people are demanding this because their knowledge has increased, their technology has increased, and our youth are proudly struggling day and night to see their soldiers in the sea more firmly and with more authority.
سربازانشون رو در دریا استوارتر و با اقتدار بیشتری شاهد باشن.
It's interesting that you're mentioning that we've really gone in all various directions now and are present there, as you said, of course, in terms of showing our presence and going there in peace and trying to establish friendly relations with friendly nations who exist around the world. My question is this, are we going to maybe see in the future a time when the Navy of the Islamic Republic goes into the Pacific Ocean, maybe goes through the Panama Canal, goes through some of the countries that are maybe considered countries that they wouldn't have even dreamed of one day that the Iranian Navy would be passing by them? Is there anything in the future that you can tell us in this regard?
I want to deliver this message to all the people of the world that Iranians are very peaceful people with a humanitarian culture, and our country is not vulnerable despite all the conspiracies and efforts made by the distant enemy to harm it. The people of the world should know that if they are stuck in the middle of the seas in any way, the Iranian Navy will surely come to the rescue, even in the depths of the seas.
At the end of our conversation, I would like to ask you a question a bit more personal regarding your own life and the path you have taken in your own life. As you know, there have been issues now in Iran, and also this has been unfortunately exploited by our enemies, talking about the different ethnic groups that live in Iran. Of course, those of us who live in Iran know that none of that is true, that we live in peace here. All the different ethnic groups live in peace in Iran and are brothers and sisters of each other, and some of the things that are said are basic lies about what the reality is in Iran. You yourself were born in the beautiful province of Kurdistan. It's very interesting, I think, for our audience to hear what happened in your own life. Kurdistan is very far from the sea. It's not a coastal area. It's actually a mountainous area, very far from the sea. So how is it that a young man from Kurdistan comes towards the sea and ends up being the commander of the Navy of the Islamic Republic of Iran?
First of all, I would like to use this opportunity to extend my blessings and appreciation to Iranian Kurds, my fellow citizens, and thank them for not being deceived by the enemy. This issue is not only limited to this day, but for decades the enemy has been trying to abuse this issue of ethnic tension and create discord. Of course, it is not only the issue of ethnic differences, but the enemy also tries to create divisions within the country through sowing discord among Shias and Sunnis. All the efforts by the enemies to create unrest in Iran at the borders have so far failed, thanks to the unity that exists among the different ethnic groups who live in the border areas. Therefore, I would like to extend my warmest greetings and appreciation to all of them. And finally, about myself, I must say that during the war, my father fought on land against the enemy aggression, but I myself was interested in experiencing new environments since my childhood, and I had a special interest in the sea. My dream was to sail across the Indian Ocean someday and reach Australia. When I finished high school, one day I came across a Navy ad on TV. The advertisement went like this: join the Navy and see the world. Well, it was a difficult decision, you're right. Someone who is thousands of kilometers away from the sea now wants to go and experience an environment that he has known.